Well, we've been visiting some men in the Bible. Last night, if you remember, we were talking about Joseph, 17-year-old, who came from a dysfunctional family. They hated him enough to want to kill him. But we learned from him that for God, the shortest distance between two points could be a circle. And that sometimes when you think you're marking time, you're making time with God. This morning we were talking with Kohelet, the preacher, Ecclesiastes, a man who stated very frankly that for him life was meaningless. It was vain, it had no purpose. In that case, there's only one thing you can do, turn to God. Trust his sovereignty, rejoice in his goodness, live with his justice. Tonight, I want to talk about another character in the Bible. His name is David. He was king over Israel. When you say that David was a king, you mean he was a 24-carat king. He wasn't some desert nomad who took that title for himself, forced his followers to call him king. He was not some cheap politician had taken over a city, caused the people there to call him your majesty. Now, David was a king. He was at his highest, the king of Israel, king of Judah, king of Ammon, king of Moab, king of the Jebusites, king of the Canaanites, king of the Syrians, king of the Philistines. As far as the eye could see, as far as the foot could walk, David was the man. But it's more, David got to the top the hard way. Did not have the kingship handed to him on a golden platter. He had battles to fight. Battles, for example, with his family. He was the last of eight children, six brothers, seven brothers, two daughters, two sisters. They looked at him as the runt of the family. His father didn't even count him when it came to looking at somebody who might be the king. He had to fight against the Philistines. Historians would say that was his biggest fight. But he beat them. He beat them, first of all, when he went up against their giant, Goliath. A boy against the champion. But he beat him. And then he beat him again in guerrilla warfare. And finally, he beat them army against army when he drove the Philistines back into the sea. He also had to fight against Saul. Saul was the first king of Israel, and God had told David that he was going to be the king. Kings don't sit easily together. And so Saul became jealous of David, tried to kill him. He pursued him like a dog pursues a rabbit out into the wilderness, up into the mountains. For 10 years, David was public enemy number one. You don't know how well off you were. For 10 years, he was public enemy number one. And then finally, he was made king. David the king had a lot going for him, but he also had a lot going against him. When we meet David, we realize he also had problems in his marriages. His marriage, he had several of them. One was with the daughter of Saul. He married her, I think, primarily to get into king space. It looked like it had something going for it. But ultimately, she became a critic and a shrew. And then there was Abigail. She was not a convenience. He met her and fell wildly in love with her. As soon as he could, he married her, took her to be his wife. They enjoyed several years of love and romance together, but after a while, it all kind of fizzled out. But it's something he had to deal with, something he had to fight against. But David was a king, a genuine 24-karat king. When we come to meet him in 2 Samuel chapter 11, the travel agent has booked us into Jerusalem, first 2 weeks in April. It's a beautiful time in Israel. There's the sun beating down, the hardening of the ground, the growing of the flowers. It was a time when kings went forth to war. The chariots would no longer stick in the mud. It was a time when the champions appeared, were made. So we've come to meet him here in Jerusalem, except that we've discovered that this is a time when kings go forth to war. David was a king, he was a champion, he was a hero. But when we get to Jerusalem, we discover that David is not out fighting. He stayed at home. Oh, that makes sense. I mean, he's a king, he's a top administrator, he's got a lot of things to do. Has to supervise the running of a nation, of countries outside his nation. So he has the scut work of fighting all done by other people, other generals. He can pay attention to being king. So we hope we'll get a glimpse of him as we walk past the throne room. That's what we've come for. But we walk past the throne room and we discover he's not in the throne room. He's up on the roof of the palace in an enclosure designed to capture the afternoon breezes. And David, the mighty king of Israel, is asleep. Well, that shouldn't surprise us. A nap in the afternoon, in fact, if he were older, you would expect that. It's a way to keep your strength. If he were younger, you might suspect that he was sick and he had to go to take a nap in the afternoon. But for whatever the reason, David's asleep. But somebody's made some noise and he awakens. And he stretches and walks along the roof of the palace. He looks over the edge of the palace and in a courtyard of one of the nearby houses, he sees a beautiful woman. She's tall, lean, lovely. He feels the passion stirring inside of him again. And then she drives off, goes into the house. But David doesn't want to leave it there. He can't take his eyes off her. He won't take his eyes off her. And he says to one of the servants nearby, look, who lives in that house there? Okay. How about that one there? Oh, yeah. That's the home of Uriah the Hittite. His wife's name is Bathsheba. She's a very intelligent girl, isn't she? You know, I've been thinking about doing something for the wives of the soldiers. I need to talk to somebody like Betsy. Maybe she could help me. When you go down there, invite her to come and we'll spend some time together. And the biblical writer just simply says, he sent messages to get her. She came. He slept with her. She went back to her house. Bible's maddening. I mean, the things I would love to know, and it doesn't tell me. What was it like when they met? Was it long? Was it slow? Was it romantic? Was it quick and passionate, closer to rape than to love? I don't know. Simply invited her to come to the palace. They slept together. She went back to her house. In the words of the scriptures, they committed adultery. Oh, you're right, it's such a shabby word. David would never have called what they did adultery. He would have called it a meaningful affair. Afternoon fling, spring interlude, but not adultery. And why is it that Christians have to take something like that, that's slow and beautiful and lovely, and foul it with a word like adultery? But 3 weeks later, he gets a note from Bathsheba. It simply says, "I am pregnant, sign B." It's not quite as easy to talk about as our society says it is. I mean, this act of joining two bodies together from which there comes another life that will live someplace forever. Not quite as innocent as we like to make it. David got that note, and it upset him. He found his temples pounding. He found it hard to breathe, and he knew he had to act. And so after a while, he calmed down and then put a plan into practice. He wrote a note to Joab, his general, who was out in the field fighting. He said, "Send home Uriah. I want to talk to him." And so, days so later, Uriah comes home. Now, David knew he had the plan for that. He just couldn't have Uriah come home for no reason. Uriah was one of David's 30 mighty men, and you don't get to be a mighty man by being a fool. He had to make it look good. Thank you for coming, Uriah. Appreciate you making the trip. You can't imagine how frustrating it is to have to stay here in Jerusalem while the men are out in the field. And I can't get accurate reports. But you've been there. You know what it's like. How are we doing? Is Joab leading the forces against the rabble of the city? How is the morale of the men? How long do you think it'll take to take that city? All the right questions. And then when he had finished, he said to Uriah, "Uriah, I can't tell you how happy I am to have this conversation. Now look, you go back to your house tonight and spend some time with Bathsheba. I'll send along some food so you have something to eat. But you want to go down and enjoy your home." And so Uriah left David's presence. But that night, he didn't go home. He simply stayed at the palace. I've often wondered how David found out about that. Maybe it was the next morning at breakfast. One of the servants says, "You know, it's fun having Uriah home. He kept us awake for half the night telling us stories about the battle. He is a storyteller." And I'm sure that David wasn't too happy to hear that. He didn't go home. He stayed at the palace. So as soon as he could, David got hold of Uriah. Uriah, what's this I hear about you? Didn't go home last night. I couldn't imagine it, having been away as long as you were, that you could just not go to be with Bathsheba. He said, I'm sorry, I couldn't do that. You see, my men are back in the field, sleeping in pup tents, eating rations. And I just couldn't do that. I just felt it would be wrong. And David said, well, I admire your commitment. I was going to send you back today, but I have a communique and it's not ready yet. You have to go back tomorrow. Look, I know the men in the field would appreciate your devotion. The men are going to be glad that you came and that you didn't go home last night. But this night, they would understand. In fact, if they were here, they would tell you to do it. But that night, too, Uriah stayed at the palace, didn't go home. And finally, David felt he'd lost the game, but he wasn't going to lose the tournament. So he says to Uriah, look, got to stay home one more day. Have dinner with me. We just need to have some man talk. Talk about what's going on in your life and in the battle and with the armies. It was David's plan to get Uriah tipsy. Get him to go home. Drop his inhibitions. And so they ate, they talked, they ate, they talked, they drank, they drank and then talked and ate. And finally, when Uriah was tipsy, he staggered from the presence of the king. But he didn't go home that night either. He stayed at the palace, kept his commitment to his men. So the next day, David put the second part of his plan together. He sat down and wrote to Joab, his general, and said, take Uriah and put him at the forefront of the battle, then withdraw. Let him be killed. Sealed the envelope and gave the death warrant to Uriah to take back to Joab. And Joab did what he knew he was supposed to do. His armies attacked the city. And he said to the messenger who he sent back after the battle where Uriah was killed, he said to him, listen, when you go back, explain to David that Uriah was killed. Say that to him two or three times. But tell him we get close to the wall and some men were shot. The arrows came down upon them. But you be careful of how you say it. Tell him Uriah the Hittite was killed. So the messenger came back to David, told him about the victory. To tell the king that you got too close to the wall was like telling a coach in baseball that you threw the ball to third base when the winning run was coming home at the end of the night. It was a bonehead play. In fact, 200 years before, there was a man by the name of Abinadab who got too close to the wall of the palace. And a woman took a large millstone and dropped it on his head. And whenever the soldiers talked about that, they talked about old Batty Abimelech got too close to the wall, got killed. So Joab said, when you get back, you tell the king that Uriah was killed. So the messenger comes back and he gives the news to David. He said, sir, we went up against the city of Rabbah. We got close to the walls and a number of our men were killed by the arrows. And among them was Uriah the Hittite. I don't think that messenger ever understood David's reaction. David said, well, that's the way it is in battle. You win some, you lose some. You lose some good men, you win some battles, that's the way it is. When you go back, you tell Joab, I appreciate what he's done. Keep up the good work. Tell him I'm solidly behind him. And I don't think that messenger ever understood what occurred. And then the report about Uriah came back to the city. And within a couple of weeks of his death, David and Bathsheba began the ceremonies to be married. After about 7 months, they had the baby. But nobody knew. David could cover it up. He had danced the dance and didn't have to pay the orchestra. I mean, nobody knew. No, nobody could know. Oh, of course, Joab knew, but Joab was one of the king's men. But nobody knew, not really. Oh, people back then could count to 9 just as well as they can today. It was 7 that they had. But they didn't know, not for sure. David had covered it up. So nobody knew, not really. But David, 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 somebody knows the last line of chapter 11. Said that what David did displeased the Lord. God knew. God knew. David, God knows. Somebody else knew, and that was Nathan the prophet. We don't know how he knew. He may have been just a keen observer of the human condition. Remembered Uriah coming back and then being killed in battle, and then the quick wedding and the coming of the baby. But he had to talk to the king about his sin. Dangerous stuff. Dangerous to confront a king. Dangerous to confront a king who's already killed a man. Dangerous to confront a king who's got a guilty conscience. And so Nathan worked on his introduction. I mean, you got to be careful of introductions when you talk to the guilty king. He said, Your Majesty, there's a man here in your kingdom. He was poor. He had one little ewe lamb. He loved that little lamb. It was like a daughter to him. It slept with him at night. Children played with it. I mean, it was his little ewe lamb. And then across the way, there was a wealthy farmer who had sheep and cattle and all kinds of stuff. He had a visitor from a distant country, but instead of taking one of his flock or lamb, a flock or a herd, he took that lamb that belonged to the poor farmer. And no sooner had he told the story, but he knew he scored. He could see it in David's eyes. The fire was there. He could see it in David's fists. They were curled. And David said, the man who does that or did that deserves to die. He will restore fourfold what he has taken. And Nathan said, sir, you're the man. Imagine David slumping back in his throne. He stares at Nathan's face to see if this is some kind of grim joke, but Nathan is not laughing. And David realized that God knew. and saying what he said, he'd already passed judgment on himself. The king was guilty before God. Nathan went on to tell him that God knew and that God was not going to shut his eyes to it. And then David said, I have sinned against the Lord. Think of that. He had sinned with Bathsheba, he had sinned against Uriah, he had sinned against the baby, but he says, I have sinned against the Lord. And he knew what that meant. The law of God applied to kings and commoners. He knew what that meant. So did Nathan. And Nathan said, sir, you will not die. You deserve to, but you will not die. God will forgive you. I think that of all the things Nathan could have said, it was that word about forgiveness that meant the most. He knew about death. He had faced it on the battlefield a score of times. But God had forgiven him. But then Nathan said, what you have done has displeased God, and what you have done will become a mockery to your enemies. So the baby that's coming will die. And you will pay a price for what you've done. A principle, important principle. Forgiveness is a great gift from God, but forgiveness does not wipe out consequences. It just doesn't. And the consequences kept coming. The baby died, and then Amnon, one of the sons of David, had a crush on his sister Tamar, half-sister. More than a crush, he burned with desire for her, and then he connived to get into her apartment, and he raped her. Vicious, cruel rape wiped out that young woman. Then Amnon, the brother of Tamar who was raped, waits over a year. When they had a banquet, he had Amnon killed. Murdered. That young man over there, that's Absalom. Tall, handsome, charming, good looking. He is the brother of Tamar. He knows what Amnon has done. And he waits quite a while. Has him killed. And he decides he's going to rebel against his father. And he does. He rebels. He gets all the people together. He's a charming man, striking figure, gives them anything they want. They follow him. They go up against David in Jerusalem, but David doesn't want to fight in the holy city. So he goes out from the city. And they have a fight. They have a war, a battle beyond the Jordan. And in that battle, Absalom is killed. Killed by Joab, same man who arranged for the killing of Uriah. Absalom was riding on his mule, went underneath a tree, had this long hair caught in the branches. he dangled between heaven and earth, and Joab took his dagger, killed him. And David's heart was broken. He said, "Oh, Absalom, my son, Absalom, Absalom, my son, my son. Would to God I had died instead of you, Absalom, my son." He went to say, "Would to God you had lived for him." But Absalom is dead. You see that boy over there? He's about, what, 3 years of age, four? That's Adonijah. When he grows up and gets into his early 20s, he's going to rebel against David, who at that time is going to be an old man. He's going to try to take over the kingdom by taking over the throne. And David knows what he's doing, has him killed. Forgiveness doesn't wipe out consequences. It just doesn't. That's the story. It was a kind of midlife crisis because David, when it happened, was about 48, 49 years of age. I'm sure he was going through what some of us have gone through. He began to change. He saw his hair turning white or dropping out. He saw his flesh and his face grow more tender. And he had a porch. He didn't have that when he was a young man. When he was running away from Saul, he could leap over walls and never even think about it. But now he has a porch. David felt that, felt he was getting older. He tried to solve his problem with Bathsheba, but it caused all kinds of problems for the rest of his life. Talk about a midlife crisis. That's what David experienced. Years ago, when I was preaching up in Canada, I met a pastor. His name was John. You don't need to know his last name. I was impressed. I came home and I said to my wife, "He may be the best pastor I have ever served with. He really knows how to pastor a church." And after that, he moved out here to California. And then I heard that he had an affair with three women in his church. It was discovered in an afternoon. Imagine that. I mean, in the morning he leaves, people looked up to him, admired him. By the evening he has been discovered to be an adulterer. When I heard that, I flew out to California just to be with him. He's a friend. Didn't go as a judge, just went as a friend. When I got there, I found his son, took him out to dinner. I had led his son to Christ about 2 or 3 years before, so we knew each other quite well. I asked him how he was doing. He wasn't doing well. I mean, his whole world had crashed in with what his father had done. Next day, I went to meet my friend John. We just sat like at a funeral, didn't talk much. Finally, I said, "John, what do I tell the guys at seminary? I mean, stuff we teach it doesn't seem to matter when we have something like this. What would I tell them?" And he said to me, "Tell them this. Tell them that when a man fails to walk with God, he walks on the edge of an abyss." I've told that to my students. I tell it to you. I've told it to myself 100 times. When someone fails to walk with God, they walk on the edge of an abyss. When John Knox was in his 40s, he had a very flat place in his life. And yet, in one of his journals, he wrote these words: "I will keep the ground that God has given me. And perhaps, by his grace, he will ignite me again. But ignite me in that, I will hold the ground." It strikes me that's the commitment of your middle years. I will keep the ground God has given me, and perhaps in his grace he will ignite me again. But ignite me or not, by his grace and his power, I will hold the ground. If David had committed himself to that, the story would have been different. I say that to you today. If you fail to walk with God, you walk on the edge of an abyss. So there needs to be a commitment deep in the soul, wherever you make commitments. I will keep the ground God has given me. And perhaps it is grace. He will ignite me again. But ignite me or not, I will hold the ground. Will you pray with me? Father, this is the story of an ancient king in a piece of literature written well over 3,000 years ago. And yet it's as relevant as what goes on in the lives of men and women today. I pray for your grace upon these men, to see the seriousness of what it means to fail to walk with God. The abyss is very real and very dark and very deep. And I pray for them that they will hold the ground God has given them. And perhaps in your grace you will ignite them again, but whether you ignite them or not, by your grace and your power, in your strength, help them to hold the ground. We ask this for their sake and for the sake of the churches they pastor and live in, sake of their families, and most of all for your sake. Amen.